On this Tuesday edition of Baseball Barbacast, we look at the San Francisco Giants. What a strange team that just added a strange player in Luis Arraez. Where does he fit? Is this a good move, a bad move? Are the Giants going to be any good in 2026? We talk about the Mariners, Rays, and Cardinals combining for a three-way Brendan Donovan swap. Very interesting move there. A couple other transactions from the weekend. Tarek Skubal heads to arbitration. And of course, we have to talk about insurance, all that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world willing to pay for Francisco Lindor's WBC insurance. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. What's the copay?
I'll chip in a few bucks to help Francisco Lindor play in the WBC in Puerto Rico. That, I mean, worthy cause. There is an amount that I would contribute if I was guaranteed that he would be playing. But it does sound GoFundMe. Like it is probably pretty pricey. We are going to do some insurance chatter on this Tuesday edition of Baseball Barbacast. Exactly what we thought we would be talking about here on this first February.
That's why you listen to the show.
Edition of the
you
show.
You want to know what Jake and Jordan have to say about insurance, or as some people say, insurance.
Yes, that is it's almost the difference between, I've had this debate with my wife about umbrella versus umbrella. Have you heard umbrella? Like, you know, you better grab umbrella. An umbrella. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to grab some insurance or some insurance. You know, you joke about that, Jake, but it was over the weekend when we were talking about this WBC insurance situation. You're like, I got to, like, you were like, put me in, coach. Like, I'm excited to write about insurance.
Yeah.
This is,
I was early.
And I'm glad you did.
I was working on a Saturday, baby, working the phone lines. And we will talk about that on this episode in the third block. Okay. So if that's all you want to know, just skip the rest of the show. But if you, I'm kidding, please don't do that. To start the show, we're going to do something a little bit different, which is talk about the San Francisco Giants, one of the most bizarre baseball teams to have ever existed. That is our opener. Weird player joins weird team. Luis Arraez is headed to the San Francisco Giants on a one-year, $12 billion free agent contract. In a game, in a world full of big swingers, strikeouts, and long balls, Arraez is a throwback player. And just like many things that are throwback, he might be worse than modernity. That is the debate about Luis Arraez. Remember, like, if you want to go on a road trip, you're not driving a 1972 car. You would prefer to drive the newest updated model. And Luis Arraez is certainly a polarizing figure. Jordan, he's going to play second base for the Giants. He played first base and DH for the San Diego Padres the last few years, reporting indicating that Arraez, that was like a priority for him. He turned down multiple multi-year offers to be a DH. He wanted to play second base. He is not particularly good at playing second base, according to recent statistics from recent seasons. What do you make of this? Like, this is, it gives him one of the most fascinating infields in the sport with Matt Chapman, Willie Adames, Luis Arraez, Rafael Devers. And it just adds to what has been a very bizarre, very enticing, scintillating offseason for the Giants, because it's like, how does this story go?
Yeah, so I think I've been so excited to just do this conversation, and that is why we are leading with, there are bigger moves that have been made. We will talk about Brendan Donovan in the second part of this podcast, but I think with Arraez, let's just break it into the three sections, right? There's the defensive conversation, there's the offensive conversation, and then there's really why we are opening with the Giants, which is just the Giants as an operation, where they are going, where they have been, and how Arraez fits into that. So let's start with the first thing that you just said, which is what was predictably what a lot of people reacted to first and foremost, was Arraez to play second base. He sucks at second base. What a horrible idea to put Luis Arraez at second base and have the player with, you know, the most negative OAA in the sport play infield for a team whose best pitcher is the best ground ball pitcher in the league, right? Let alone another pitcher who they just added this offseason, Adrian Houser. That's another ground ball pitcher who they're clearly counting on, right? And I think that it's hard to say that that take is completely wrong. I think we have to consider the fact that the Giants, we know based on the reporting, they were trying to upgrade second base. And I think that that is correct. We can talk about where Casey Schmidt fits into this. I know there are some numbers that say he had a pretty good season last year. I think Casey Schmidt is a useful player to have. I also think that it is not an accident that the whole winter we heard that the Giants were trying to upgrade at this position. If you looked at the Fangraphs depth charts for you know, projected WAR at second base, they were in the bottom five easily. They did not add, that was a group that they had not changed whatsoever, whether it was Casey Schmidt, Tyler Fitzgerald, Christian Kotz. This was a weak unit, a clear weak spot. They did not think that Casey Schmidt was worthy of that. So they tried for CJ Abrams. They tried for Brendan Donovan. They tried for Nico Hoerner, it sounds like. Probably because their farm system isn't very good, they were unable to make any of those moves. And now they settle on Arise, which is a really interesting choice because of how bad his defensive reputation is. Let's introduce Ron Washington as a character, right? Ron Washington, the iconic infield coach who has joined this fascinating Giants coaching staff led by Tennessee head coach Tony Vitello, making his foray into professional baseball. Can Wash magically make Luis Arise a plus defender after years and years of him being a bad defender? Probably not. But it is at least something that we are going to watch be clearly a priority in spring training. So the defensive decision is undeniably questionable. So I am willing to accept that as fact. And I think when you add in the Devers part about this, I think that part is maybe a little bit overblown. I think Devers can become a good first baseman. That would not surprise me whatsoever. And on the left side of the infield, you have two really good defenders, and you've upgraded your outfield defense by signing Harrison Bader. So on the whole, is the Giants' defense going to be better this year than last year? That's going to be an interesting thing to see. I think you could argue no. I think you could argue yes. So Arise is an interesting part of that equation for sure from the defensive side. So that is my thoughts about him as a defender. I understand you can't dispute how bad the numbers have been. I also don't think it is an abomination for them to attempt him to be there because of the offensive potential upside, which we're about to get to. Anything else that you have on the defensive side of this decision before we get to the bat?
Two things. One, Ron Washington will be an important part of this. Yeah. But I think an even more important part of this is going to be whoever is doing the Giants positioning. Because Arise's issues as a defender are not his hands, right? And Wash, over the years, that is like what he has been particularly good at, right? He got helped get Austin Riley's hands good enough to be a third baseman. But it is very difficult in a short span of time to help, one, someone's arm strength, and two, someone's lateral mobility. And those are where Arise falls short. And so for him to be simply a below average second baseman, like that would be a win. In order for that to happen, the Giants are going to need to put him in the right spot, right? They're going to need to put him where the ground balls are going to go. And so whomever is in charge of this, whichever smart person, not us, like way smarter than us, is in charge of defensive positioning for the Giants, is a huge character for this team for this season. Okay, so that's like the first thing for me that comes to mind. And then the second thing is just, I really want to emphasize the skill difference between the middle infield and the corners is enormous. It's enormous. We talked about this a little bit when we were chatting about the Mets and Bo Bichette and Jorge Polanco, where the Mets felt comfortable moving those guys to corners to totally new positions, in part because they had so much experience up the middle. And being an up the middle player, up the middle defender, requires a higher level of athleticism, of mobility, and you do that year over year. Moving to the corner is going to be a little bit easier. Going the other way, and I know Arise has played second base previously in his career, he hasn't really been like an everyday second baseman in what, like two seasons, three seasons? I have concerns. I have concerns about it. If we're purely grading, like, do you think Luis Arise is going to be a good defender this year? My answer is absolutely not. But now once you take that, you have to, you know, put it in the context of the rest of what the Giants are doing, right? And I think that's where we can bring in his offensive profile. Because as far as I'm concerned, the question, is Luis Arraez a good ad? You have to compare him to, one, what they had before, and two, what else they could have done, right? So I think Luis Arraez compared to Casey Schmidt, who would have been the opening day second baseman probably otherwise, that's an upgrade in my mind, right? I think we both agree on that. Him compared to Nico Hoerner or Brendan Donovan or CJ Abrams, he's not as good as those guys, but we don't know what the Giants would have had to give up. And so as far as I'm concerned, like, Luis Arraez, for all of his flaws, makes the Giants better. I think he makes the Giants better.
I'm really glad you brought up the coaches. And by the way, we're still waiting on the full announcement for the Giants coaching staff. I think they might be the last team that has not fully put it out there and been like, this is what our coaching staff looks like. We do know that the bench coach is going to be Jace Tingler, so he's probably factoring into that. But as we know nowadays, Major League coaching staffs have so many people that are involved in positioning, whether that's the quality control coach or, you know, maybe it is the infield coach, whatever. So, but that is a great point. I'm really glad you brought that up, because that is just such a big part of why teams get outs now. And this is going to be relevant as we talk about Luis Arraez's offense here in a second, but I'm really glad you brought that up. Now, I think there are some people listening, smart people I've seen, be like, is he better than Casey Schmidt? And yes, on the whole, when you're looking at just WAR output because of Arraez, how bad Arraez's defense has been, you could say, no, Casey Schmidt could be just as good. But let's talk about the bat. Because way more important whether Luis Arraez is a minus 5 defender at second, or a minus 10 defender at second, or a plus 2 defender at second, is what he is able to do offensively. Because what is clear is that Luis Arraez has essentially, there is nothing like him. There is one player that is doing what Luis Arraez is doing. Sure, you can be like, oh, look at Stephen Kwan, and even Brendan Donovan has some shades of what isn't going on here. No, there is one player that is Luis Arraez, the player with the best bats of all skills in the sport. However, over the last 2 years, that has essentially become a self-defeating skill, because Luis Arraez, unlike earlier in his career when he was not chasing as much, he was willing to draw some walks, and he was able to tap into more power than he has recently. Now he is just swinging at everything and producing so much weak contact that he is, on the whole, not a particularly effective offensive player. But to pretend like he has never been a productive offensive player, which is the way I'm seeing him talked about, I think is just misleading and forgetting what he was for essentially 3 seasons when he first broke through with Minnesota in 22 and 23, when he was reaching base at 70, at a 36, 37, 38, 39% clip. However you're doing it, if you're reaching base that often, you are a useful offensive player. And that was not as much the case this past year when he was completely miscast as a two-hitter, which is not what we know now, that the two-hole is where you put your best player that was probably combining on base and power. And he was the worst regular two-hitter in the sport in San Diego. And for whatever reason, that is where Mike Schilt decided to bat him over and over and over and over. And he had his worst season. He still led the league in hits because he's swinging at everything and is able to put the ball in the bat, you know, the bat on the ball that often. But if your OBP sinks to 327 and you're not slugging, the fact that you're never striking out, it is no longer as valuable. But if he's able to get back to what he was a couple years ago, which, again, it's not like he's 35. I don't think that's an impossible thing. Now you have a useful hitter to plug into a lineup that already has plenty of pop and plenty of swing and miss, and also has another really intriguing contact player in Jung-Hoo Lee that gives your lineup a lot of intriguing diversity. I don't know where exactly he's going to fit into this lineup. And I think add it to the list of interesting Tony V storylines is how often is he playing with the lineup, the way that in college baseball, I mean, you'll see teams changing so often, right? I mean, if you're not liking what you're seeing for 2 games, we're shuffling things like crazy. I have to imagine that Tony V isn't going to have that level of wiggle room to just shake it up that often. But who knows where he sees Arraez fitting, whether it is at a leadoff spot, whether it's farther down the order where let's get these good hitters on base and have Arraez drive them in because we know he's not going to strike out with runners in scoring position. So there's a lot of ways that you can use this player. But my main point is, he needs to make some adjustments. And yet, I think that to have this level of contact skill cannot be viewed exclusively as a negative thing. He has moved in the direction of it becoming more of a problem than a, you know, than a pro, more of a con than a pro, because of how often he's just hitting weakly to parts of the field that are defended well. This is the other point that has been made that I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
Is when you say, oh, have teams figured out Luis Arraez? Well, in some ways, probably yes, because you mentioned defensive positioning. Because the number of places on the field that Luis Arraez is likely to hit the ball is a lot smaller, it's a lot than the average baseball player, that becomes easier to defend. You can play your left fielder really shallow. You can play your outfielder really shallow. You can play your infield in certain alignments. In that respect, there that is going to be something he is probably facing for the rest of his career. But I still believe there is a version of it in here that can be a really helpful hitter. And for 1 year and $12 million, and you weren't able to get these other guys, I think it's a good move. So that is where I'm at in the context of me believing that Luis Arraez can be helpful. But now we have to zoom out. Because the real problem with the discourse around Arraez is that it is fitting in to the discourse around the San Francisco Giants, which, if we're being honest, is an operation over the last three, since they randomly won 107 games, has not gained a whole lot of credibility. And so when a team like this, who has been
of mediocrity,
the epitome of exactly. And so if another smart team was like, hey, we do believe in Luis Arraez, if the Brewers had signed Luis Arraez and were like, we're going to platoon him with Andrew Vaughn and he's going to do some DH and we'll sprinkle him in here and there, we'd be like, oh, Brewers, no, they know something we don't. They win. They're probably right. When the Giants do it, we're like, what are this crazy group of leadership that Buster Posey's trying to lead a front office and Tony Vitello's doing this for the first time and all these things? They have to earn that. And so while I can look at the Luis Arraez move and say, I actually kind of like this, I totally understand looking at the Giants and being like, why would I trust them?
Buster Posey is an important character to fold into this because the Giants president of baseball operations took over at the end of the 20, like after 2023 or after 2024, after 2024. Mm-hmm. And when he got the job with no baseball operations experience, very little baseball operations experience, I think it was fair to say, okay, what does this guy know? Well, he knows ball. Like, he is a future Hall of Famer. He's a smart person. Like, there are parts of this that he will be good at and he will learn, right? But in my mind, the number one thing he brought to the table, and I think the most underrated trait that any sports executive can have, is getting your owner to spend money. That, in my opinion, is more important than, I mean, if you just do that, it's not going to go well. I understand if that's your one skill and like you don't know where first base is, it will end well. But I thought Buster Posey was going to be able to get Giants ownership to spend big, in part because he has that stature, right? He has those relationships. And if you're Giants ownership and Buster Posey's like, hey, we need to spend on this, you could imagine them saying yes. And to be fair, Giants ownership has made runs at Otani, made a run at Judge. They were competitive. They met both of those offers, right? Like, it wasn't them being cheap in that regard. But this offseason is just so dribs and drabs. It's so, the word in Yiddish, it's very schwach. Like, it doesn't intimidate you. It doesn't overwhelm you. And it's hard to see how they compete with the Dodgers in this division.
Yeah. And that's the other thing. We know that any conversation about the NL West is particularly challenging. And we can like a lot of the individual moves and feel like they have improved the roster and look at the team in place. And the other argument, if you want to just go full ownership propaganda, is we basically just signed Rafael Devers in June, right?
Sure.
I mean, that's pretty much what happened. And like, I can't totally dispute that. They took on the entirety of the contract and he's now on the team, which he wasn't at this time a year ago. And that's a huge piece to add in a very strange sequence of events.
Adamas and Chapman, they both gave a lot of money to. I understand that.
They gave the money for sure. And as you mentioned, maybe they have tried to give other people money that haven't taken it. And is there still one really good pitcher out there that they could sign, Framber Valdez? Yes. That would be another way to prove us wrong. More ground balls for Luis Arraez to field. So that would be funny. But on the whole, when we really we prepare to preview the season and think about whether I'm actually feeling good about the Giants, you can look at the lineup and be like, what a weird group of hitters. Is this going to work? How is Tony V going to do this? The problems are on the mound. I mean, I mentioned the Fangraphs projected depth charts earlier. This is just not a unit that has been reinforced to any degree that makes me feel good about how they're going to stack up in this division. It's a bullpen that has barely been addressed whatsoever that ranks, I think, again, on Fangraphs, like bottom five. The rotation is bottom 10. And I like the lineup. I'm excited to watch the lineup, but this is just not an amount of pitching that I'm going to look at and be like, yeah, that's a postseason team.
Well, it's really shallow. The whole roster is really shallow. There's not a lot of depth on either side of the ball. And to win 94 games, you need your second level of players to step up and be helpful, or you need luck. You need the baseball lords in the sky to smile down upon you.
They used it all in 2021. I don't know when they're going to get that much luck again in any individual season, but since then they've just been stuck at 500, and no matter what they do, they've changed the roster many times over. And but now it is like, that's the thing. You mentioned Posey. Now I'm looking at a team that seems to be one that Buster Posey wanted to build. And yes, we mentioned there's some examples of them spending or not spending. The payroll is still nowhere near the first luxury tax threshold, which you should very reasonably argue as the Giants, they should be absolutely there. Okay, maybe they're within 10 or 15 million, but still, like, they should be with the Cubs and the Red Sox at the very least as clear, easily top 10 payrolls in the sport, and they just have been floating right below that.
I was talking to a scout recently about something or other, and the scout said, how many teams in the last 10 years have won a World Series without a truly elite player? A truly elite player. And because I am a loser, I went to answer this question. Okay, there's no perfect way to do this, obviously, but I went through all the World Series winners since 2010, just for fun, to see how much Baseball Reference wins above replacement does the best player on that team that wins the World Series have, right? Mm-hmm. The lowest team leader in WAR for a team that won the World Series in the last decade is Austin Riley on the 2021 Braves at 6.3 wins above replacement. Okay. Mm. When you look at this list, Otani, Marcus Semien, who had a 7.7 WAR season, like, he was an elite player that year, finished third in MVP. They had Seager finish second, Yordan Alvarez finishing third. And I also put like MVP finish on here. If you want to win a World Series, producer Hearts, you can edit this and bleep it. You need to have a monster on your team. You need to have monsters.
At least one.
It is not like at least one. This is not a sum of its parts thing. You need to have game changers. And the Giants, in my opinion, do not have that player. They have a lot of very good players. Willy Adames, Matt Chapman, Rafael Devers. Going and getting Devers is good. Is Devers that guy? I don't think he's that guy. I think he's great. Is Rafael Devers going to have a 6.5 to 7 win season in his career?
He's never done it. I think him, to be clear, I just want to clarify, and this is an important part of this conversation. We're just talking about position players. I'm not saying I'm agreeing or disagreeing, but just to be clear.
All of the leaders were position players for all of these teams.
Great.
So it does include pitchers. So like Logan Webb, I think, is this. Okay? He is this. But I think you need to have a hitter version of this.
Sure. I think Devers is right below it. I don't think it is implausible that he could have... Like, to say, you're basically saying, is Rafael Devers' best year of his career still ahead of him? That is a pretty bold claim. I don't think it is impossible. But I still agree with your general point that he, especially when you consider he is just a now a first base DH guy, it will be even harder for him to get to a 6 or 7 WAR season. But I think he's an important part of that. I think, again, a year ago, they really didn't have anybody like this. And now they're closer to it because I do believe in Devers to that degree. But I think it's a fair point. And I think it just goes back to the larger thing about the Giants, which is they have chased some, they've gotten some, and it's just not enough.
Just to finish this thought about like teams that win the World Series, I'll just go by MVP finish, okay? Going back in time. Otani, one. Seager, 2. Jordan, 3. Austin Riley, 7 is the outlier. Mookie, 2nd. Anthony Rendon, 3rd. Mookie Betts for the Red Sox in 18, 1st. Altuve in 17, 1st. Chris Bryant in 16, 1st. Lorenzo Cain in 2015, 3rd. So, like, you basically have to have someone who's going to finish in the top 3 of MVP to win the World Series. I understand the correlation causation, but this is not an accident. And so I just look at this roster and I'm like, man, they need that guy. And they tried to get that guy with Judge and Otani and whatever. And those guys, I mean, that's the whole thing. Those guys are impossible to find. You get a player like that. That's why the Red Sox trading Mookie Betts is like mind-blowing. You had, they're called unicorns because they're rare, right? And the Giants don't have that. But part of the problem I think that's going to happen this year is that they kind of like also don't have the depth, right?
Yes.
Because they haven't drafted and developed very well, like at the end of the Farhan Zaidi era, they don't have that second level. There's this very bizarre like range of talent on this team where they have so many dudes that are like 4s and 5s and 6s, but they don't have a lot of 3s and they have no 7s.
Also, that lack of depth and just that era of not developing talent to either bolster your own roster or give you the pieces to trade for Brendan Donovan, to trade for Nico Horner, to trade for CJ Abrams. They just don't have those. There's some exciting things happening at the lower levels of the Giants farm system.
Yeah.
But those trade pieces are just not quite as valuable in today's game. That I think is pretty indisputable right now, that a lot of those, there are not a lot of teams, even the rebuilding ones, who are willing to lead their trade package with a player in A-ball. That's just not normally how this is going. So maybe a year from now, they have more pieces to trade for. Maybe even by the time the deadline comes around, there are enough strides in their system that they can make a win now move if they're in the mix. But the depth is also even more important what helps you get to October. Once you get there, you do need, as you mentioned, you need those superstars to carry you for the most part. But getting through 162 games and hanging around in these crowded wildcard races, even if it is technically easier to get in because the bar has been lowered. And by the way, that should also speak to how embarrassing the Giants operation has been recently. When you look at some of the teams
that have snuck into
the National League wildcard picture, you know, whether it's the Reds, whether it's the Marlins, and the Giants have failed with payrolls well above those teams to even get there, you know, towards the end of the season. So as we approach opening day, I still think there is a world where I'm looking at this middle tier of National League teams and buying in and being like, you know what? I'll ride with this Giants team and they will finally break forward and win 86 games instead of 81. But I'm still a little bit wary because, like we just said, they have to earn it. And there's enough new things happening now that makes me excited and want to believe that it can be different. But they don't have that credibility yet. So we will see how it goes. They're easily one of the handful of teams I'm most excited to see how their season goes this year. All right. Any final thoughts of the Giants before we take a break?
No.
All right. We will take a quick break. When we return, Brendan Donovan is a Mariner. Finally, we'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Since we last recorded, a slew, a torrent, a thunderstorm of moves have happened. A rarity for this late in the offseason. It's February. The groundhog in Pennsylvania did or did not see his shadow. I don't know. There's snow on the ground. Let's go around the league. But the Pittsburgh Pirates already traded for a second baseman this offseason. And so Brendan Donovan got the second best thing. Because what is a Pirate, Jordan, but a Mariner?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess those are just the same team. If you really think about it, this is a move we have all been waiting for. This was one of the most heavily rumored trade targets of the entire winter. Brendan Donovan, who has quietly had one heck of a start to his career. I mean, this is a former seventh round pick who hit his way to the majors, and I don't think I quite registered how good his rookie season was. Not just particularly his rookie season. And I included this little fun fact in my write-up of the trade last night. Brendan Donovan, by the way, is on the Mariners. Ben Williamson is now on the Rays for reasons we can get into. The Cardinals bringing in some prospects and a couple draft picks. But let's keep the focus on Donovan. When he arrives in 2022, you know, it feels weird now because the Cardinals are totally tearing it down. Cardinals were really good. They were winning the division. And this guy, who was not a top prospect whatsoever after being a seventh round pick in 2018, essentially hit his way to the majors and was known for his defensive versatility. And what Brendan Donovan did as a rookie was astonishing. I mean, he only hit five homers, .394 on base percentage. I don't know if you saw this fun fact in my story last night, but this was some good arbitrary stat heading, but I did enjoy it. Fifth highest on base percentage by a rookie in the 21st century.
Wow.
Minimum 450 plate appearances. Aaron Judge, Albert Pujols, Mike Trout, Juan Soto, Brendan Donovan.
That's awesome.
Now, again, it's a little goofy, but hey, like, dude was getting on base nearly 40% of the time. He was playing essentially every position except for catcher and center field. He wins the first ever utility gold glove in the National League in 2022. Since then, his bat has been more good than great. He does struggle against left-handers. He doesn't have a ton of raw power, but he is an elite contact hitter. His strikeout rates have been, you know, among the 5 to 10 lowest in the league. He walks at a solid clip. He has just enough power to rack up enough doubles and homers to where your outfield cannot play all the way in the way you can against Luis Arraez. And he's just been a really complete baseball player who's been able to handle second base, left field, third base. He's seen some time at shortstop, played some first. And with Seattle, he was a perfect target because of their needs in the infield at second and third. Now, how big of a need were those? We can talk about that. But I know Brendan Donovan is a player that is certainly endeared himself to you since he debuted in 2022. So before we get to the Mariners fit, what do you see in this guy as a ball player?
The pride of Enterprise, Alabama, home of the boll weevil. Brendan Donovan, man, when these thoughts pop into my head, like, I want to punch myself for being cliche, but he's like the prototypical, like, winning ball player, gritty, high contact, dirt on the uniform, hair's always wet. We don't have a lot of wet guys left in baseball. It feels like our game has dried out a little bit. And Donovan is not always wet. Obviously, we have Brandon Marsh is the wettest guy. But Donovan is a pretty wet guy. That's good. He is a very, very, very good baseball player. And he makes the Mariners way better with how he fits into their positional alignment.
Yeah, so let's talk about that need and why they took their time, but they managed to get a deal done here, why he was such a perfect fit. The Mariners infield was quickly restocked when they gave Josh Naylor a bunch of money as soon as the offseason started. And I think they quickly identified that from both a lineup and positional depth chart standpoint, first base needed to be addressed as soon as possible. And they did that. They brought back Naylor. Clearly, Naylor loved it there. And, you know, we talked about that when it happened. Great fit. for the short term, long term, whatever. So you got that done. But with Jorge Polanco and Eugenio Suarez, two other members of the infield to finish the season, hitting free agency, Polanco, of course, heading to the Mets pretty quickly. And then Suarez, we're going to get to where he ended up here in Cincinnati after we're done talking about Donovan. There was never a sense that either of those guys was really going to come back. Polanco, I think they had more interest in. But that left second and third base in a state of both uncertainty, but also promise and excitement for young players. Namely, Cole Young, their first round pick a handful of years ago, who made his debut last year and had a solid stretch of performance at second base in the second half of last year, but essentially tailed off and was not playing in the postseason. They were rolling with Rivas and Polanco at second. But he debuted last year, and the organization is extremely high on Cole Young. And then, even more compelling, is Cole Emerson, who is a consensus top 10 prospect in baseball. He's only 20 years old, and he reached AAA at the end of last year. And the way that the organization has talked about him, they want to give him the opportunity to win a job out of spring training, which is a heck of a thing to say about a 20-year-old. And I think while there's reasons for excitement for both of these guys, and the organization is clearly still optimistic about the futures for both of them, they're also a team that is trying to get to the World Series for the first time ever. And even they understand that entrusting two infield spots with players with essentially no experience in the majors was probably not the move. By acquiring Donovan, who can handle both positions, they've effectively now set up a position battle. I mean, it's kind of two different positions, but for Young and Emerson to battle it out to either start at second or third, and Donovan handles the other spot, which is a cool way to handle this and gives you kind of rare versatility as opposed to shoehorning either of these guys into one spot that maybe doesn't fit for them. I think that makes a lot of sense. Ben Williamson, someone who played a lot of third base at the start of last year, he ends up in this trade going to Tampa Bay, so he's out of the picture. Ryan Bliss is another guy coming back from injury who I think could factor into second base in the event that Cole Young wins the job, and maybe they do a bit of a platoon there if Cole Emerson starts in AAA. But that's why he just made so much sense. The fact that he only making $5.8 million this year under team control for 2027, the fact that he's one of just the most bankable on-base guys in the whole league, all of it comes together to make him the perfect target. And they had the farm system depth to deal from to get a deal done, although apparently not enough to get the deal done without the Tampa Bay Rays. So before we move on to the rest of the parts of this deal, how do you see the Donovan move kind of completing the Mariners offseason, and whether it kind of brings them back to what they were before? Are they better than what they were before? Because you could argue and say, all right, you have Brendan Donovan and Rob Refsnyder in some forms replacing what they had at the end of last year in Suarez and Polanco. Naylor obviously back in the fold. Is that an upgrade? You can say yes. You can say no. I think it makes them a more complete team, more balanced team, and a lineup that is a little bit more balanced, as I mentioned. There's just more lineup diversity than what they already had. But I can kind of see it both ways.
Yeah. So I love it. I think that the Mariners as a lineup last year, I mean, you obviously watch them more than everybody else, but Jerry DePoto, the big problem with this offense was contact, right? They were bottom three in baseball in terms of swinging and missing. Brandon Donovan doesn't swing and miss. Like, that's huge. That gives them a new dynamic in their lineup that they didn't have before. So yeah, what you're balancing, right, is Suarez plus Polanco versus Brendan Donovan plus like question mark, right? And I think that you could pick either and it would be reasonable. But I like, there is a chance Emerson comes up and is a game changer right away. It's not a large chance because Major League Baseball is really difficult. But I think that giving yourself the opportunity as the Mariners, giving yourself the opportunity to have your top prospect win a job is a huge deal. Huge deal. Like, the Guardians are basically doing this with every position right now, and I think that that's a flaw. But having Brendan Donovan come in gives you the balance to have that, have one spot. It's like the scene in Dark Knight where he like, we're having tryouts and he breaks the pool cue. It's like, go figure it out. Cole Emerson, you know, Cole Young, go make it happen.
Yeah. And it's just a better balance of there's less urgency. It's a more healthy competition that doesn't put you in a spot where when you're projecting the lineup, you're like, ooh, two spots with rookies or close to it. That's a little bit more dicey. The thing that Donovan doesn't bring is, go ahead.
Is speed. Yeah, he's not very fast, is that what you're going to say?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that's the element of the leadoff guy, but it's not. He's not a base clogger. It's just he's not bringing the traditional speed of someone at the top of the lineup normally has.
If you saw the 2025 Mariners, you are allowed in the middle of the season to go out and get new players to help reinforce your squad. So in the event that Cole Young and Cole Emerson are not good, the Mariners can just go out and acquire either a third baseman or a second baseman, right? Mm-hmm. This gives them that leeway at the deadline too, where if you, let's say they sign Suarez, if you want to upgrade at the deadline, you have to basically go get a second baseman, right, in your lineup. Mm-hmm. Now they have more flexibility. Let's just do the cards quickly. This is, they're looking at the future, right? They now have a top five farm system in the game with all the trades that they've made this winter. I think I feel pretty confident saying that. They also are going to have an enormous bonus pool in the upcoming draft. They're going to have a ton of picks. It is going to be a franchise defining draft for the St. Louis Cardinals. As far as these prospects go, Jordan, give everybody one sentence on Ty Pete and Colton Ledbetter. I feel like I'll do Gerangelo. Mm-hmm. So, Gerangelo Sanja, that's how you, Gerangelo Sanja, Gerangelo Sanja. He, you probably know about him because he throws with both arms. Unfortunately, that is kind of turned into mostly a shtick now because he's gotten too good with his right arm, and chances are moving forward, the Cardinals may simply deploy him as a righty. The Mariners were planning to kind of focus more on that this upcoming season. We'll see how the Cardinals change course. Matt Pierpont, who is the head of pitching development with the Cardinals, used to be a big pitching guy over with the Mariners. That is going to be a helpful connection for the Cardinals. And I think this gives the Cardinals the best collection of pitching prospects in the sport.
Ooh, wow. I have not fully contemplated that, but very possible after their first-round pick last year of Liam Doyle. They have a bunch of other arms near the top of the minor leagues. A lot of depth. Gerangelo reached AA last year, so they're in no rush to get him to the majors. But what the Cardinals have clearly been targeting in a lot of their trades, and I think they will continue to do so because I don't think they're done, whether it's this offseason or at the deadline, they still have some players, whether it's Newt Barr, whether it's Jojo Romero, guys who are under contract for only a year or two more that don't necessarily fit their timeline. I think they could cash in for more guys. The pitching is really what has failed them over the last handful of years in St. Louis. And so adding upside pitching is clearly a priority, and I think what they will continue to do. And Gerangelo from the right side, he has that. I mean, fastball averages 96. The slider and changeup could both be plus. He's not particularly tall, but he's sturdy. Like he's built. And I think he still projects as a starter if he's able to kind of hone in the command. And so he pitched well in AA last year. I don't think it's wild if we see him in the majors this season, but just trying to raise the upside on the mound. As for the outfielders, Ty Pete, one of my favorite players in the draft in 2023, a really young, incredibly athletic outfielder. Shortstop at the time, was a two-way player in high school, has become a center fielder with huge power and huge speed. It looks awesome. He's striking out a ton, and he's really young, and he's going to need time to develop. He should have plenty of time to develop now with the Cardinals. He did not fit in the Mariners farm system for a lot of reasons. There were plenty of guys ahead of him that were going to be joining him. And this was an expendable piece in the larger context of the Mariners farm system. The upside here is tremendous. There's a lot of refinement to happen. Colton Ledbetter, a little bit more polished because he was a college pick. A college teammate of Gerangelo Sancho at Mississippi State in 2023. So that's an interesting little reunion. And he was a second round pick in 23. Had kind of stalled out in AA last year, but I think the Cardinals still like what they see kind of under the hood with his underlying offensive stuff. So he could still be something as well, but the picks are just huge. I mean, they're going to have six picks in the first 100, really six in the first 90 when you look at the full allotment. And that just gives your scouting department so much flexibility to add more talent in the summer. And that's where the Cardinals are at right now. And I think they already have a strong farm system. And the way that they're doing this rebuild and the kinds of players they're acquiring this year could end up being pretty bad. They could be bad. This could be a bad baseball team. But I don't think this is a 5 or 6 year situation. I think that by this time a year from now, you could be looking at a lot of this core and being pretty excited about the J.J. Weatherholtz, the Liam Doyles, Gerangelo, and so on. But there's still a lot of pressure on some of the guys that they already have to either bounce back, take steps forward, whether that's a Jordan Walker, Nolan Gorman, et cetera, et cetera. So I like what they're doing here. And I think let's bring the Rays in because...
Well, just quickly on the Cardinals.
Yeah,
just very quickly.
Go on the Cardinals.
Very quickly.
Yeah.
What I love about the Cardinals offseason is it is not a half measure.
Yep.
They are saying we are not going to be good in 2026 or we cannot win the World Series in 2026. Let's... set up an infrastructure under Chaim Bloom. Let's commit to that. And they have done that 100%. As far as the Rays goes, it's a three-team trade. And so the Rays actually have to be in it. It's in the Geneva Convention.
This is so interesting because clearly you look at the Mariners part of this and you know the Mariners and the Cardinals have been talking all offseason. And if you just say, okay, well, that means that the Mariners were probably offering Gerangelo and Ty Pete and their comp pick. And the Cardinals said, that's not enough. And for whatever reason, instead of the Mariners adding more of their prospects, they were like,
Jordan,
let me call my old pal and your old pal, Chaim Bloom. You know Eric Neander pretty
he
well.
He used to be there.
Let's get the Rays.
If you're the Mariners and you got to finish your trade, who are you going to call? Eric Neander.
Yep. And so I am most amused by the sequence of events where the Mariners realize that the Rays love Ben Williamson. Because as they were sitting on this Brendan Donovan stuck all offseason long, and when they find out that the Rays like Ben Williamson, it all comes to like, oh my God, just what we need. Just say, go, take Ben Williamson. He doesn't fit on our roster anymore. You debuted last year. Good defender. Can he hit? Who knows? We rushed him to the majors. Rays, you can take him. Just send the Cardinals some stuff. Send them Colton Ledbetter in a
care pick. Package.
And the Rays, I guess, decided that Ben Williamson was worth Colton Ledbetter in a comp pick, which I don't think is crazy. I think that like the chances of the comp pick being better than Ben Williamson are, I don't know, 50-50, probably a little bit less. Colton Ledbetter could be something. And so they felt like they needed some infield depth, some right-hand infield depth, a good defender. Sure, it's a bizarre sequence, but I don't mind it. And it is very funny and appropriate that they wiggled their way into this three-team trade. Congratulations
They've
to everybody involved.
They've been in, what, six of the last 7 3-team trades have included the Rays?
Yes, and they have also been
from John Becker.
19 of Jerry DePoto's 198 trades. So basically 10% of DePoto's trades with the Mariners have involved the Rays of Tampa Bay. What will the trade number 200 be? Stay tuned.
Ooh, good point. Jordan, we have a bunch of other moves, but we're also running long. Yep. Let's just do turbo mode. I think we can fly through some of these pretty quickly. How do you feel about that?
Faster than fast, quicker than quick. I am lightning.
I feel the need for speed.
It's turbo time.
The top free agent hitter is off the board with Eugenio Suarez heading back to the Cincinnati Reds on a 1-year, $15 million deal to play first base and DH. The Reds, who traded for Cabrian Hayes, third baseman, one of the best gloves in the sport, over there at the deadline last year, didn't really have a spot for Gino at third, but they bring him home. Gino spent a number of years in Cincinnati. It is a great, great park for his bat. He was just a very bizarre free agent case because of his age. He is 34, and because of his profile, oops, only home runs. Are you surprised that Suarez only got 1 year?
A little bit, because 49 home runs is a whole bunch of home runs. And as bad as he was in the regular season with the Mariners, 142 OPS plus with the D-backs before he was traded.
Yeah.
So that is not just home runs. Like, that is one of the best stretches of his career as a, as a hitter.
It was mostly home runs.
It was a lot of home runs. But again, yeah, I guess that was doing a lot of it. But clearly, it was enough that on the whole, it was a well above average hitter in a way that clearly the league does not view him as. I think Gino versus Arise, now that neither of them... them for war 2026 is a very interesting discussion. Gino is still the clear favorite, but that is something that clearly, for completely opposite reasons, the league looked at both of these players and said, you're not that good, or we are not going to pay you that much, whether that means the same thing. He goes back to the Reds. He doesn't want to go to the Pirates, who were also interested. And now he's going to be a DH in first base and probably hit a bunch of homers, make the Reds lineup better. Good. I mean, he's going to bring the good vibes as he always has, and I look forward to seeing him in Goodyear.
Let's put it on the wager wire, Jordan. Baseball Reference War 2026. I'll take a rise, and you take Gino.
Oh well, but see, I thought I was going to take a rise. Don't give me.
You want a rise?
I don't know. I don't know who I would pick. Yeah, that's the
you
thing.
You just said I would take Gino. You said that.
I think I said that if you look, it would be hard to argue against Gino because he's like triple what, but that's because he's been playing third base, right? And so I'm trying to account for the fact that he's not playing third anymore, and Arise playing second
and Arise is going to play
very
second
good or very bad. Is I don't know if that's going to be good or bad for his war, because the positional adjustment will be more favorable, but also if he's terrible at it, then it's problematic. I'll take Arise. I'll go Arise over
you take
Gino.
Arise.
If you don't have to
loser
agree,
gets,
I'm just saying.
No, I agree. Yeah. Loser gets a Venezuelan flag tattoo on their face.
Sounds good. Congrats to the Reds, who spent some money and now have the same payroll as the Brewers. Speaking of payroll, the Chicago White Sox made a trade for Jordan Hicks, taking on $16 million of the $25 million remaining over his next 2 years of his contract. The Red Sox are very funny, is what the Red Sox are. The Rafael Devers return is now entirely dependent on Kyle Harrison, who is like 18th on their starting pitching depth chart. They also did a bit of a prospect swap in this, where the White Sox got David Sandlin, who and the sent Gage Zeal, who they just traded for, got from the Yankees last year. This is the White Sox essentially taking on Jordan Hicks's contract and David Sandlin, who's like probably going to pitch in the big leagues for him this year, and being like, yeah, we can pay Jordan Hicks. That's fine. This is great. Good job, White Sox. This is exactly what you should do. And it would not surprise me if Jordan Hicks can be useful in some way in the context of the 2026 White Sox, which he did not appear to project to do for the 2026 Red Sox.
White Sox offseason is awesome. It is the blueprint for what a bad team that's an extra year away should be doing over the winter, right? Taking big swings on players, taking on bad contracts for prospects that aren't going to hamper them when they do need to spend in free agency. And the thing with Hicks is like, yeah, it's a bad contract. They can afford to have him start 25 games and see if it works. And if it clicks, they can just trade him away either next year or the following year. Like, I think Jordan Hicks becoming valuable enough to trade at some point in the next 2 years is what, like 25-30% chance that happens, maybe more. Like, this is a great bit of they say this in footy all the time, great bit of business from the Chicago White Sox. Quickly on the Red Sox side of the trade, Jordan Hicks obviously going from San Francisco to Boston in the Devers deal. This is from at Red Sox Stats, who tweeted the quote that Craig Breslow said about the return of the Devers deal. I'm just going to read it, okay? Quote, I think the quality of the return, we're going to see how that plays out over the next several years, but we're absolutely excited about bringing Jordan Hicks, a dominant late-inning reliever, into our mix. Bah. Kyle Harrison is someone we think can pitch in the front half of a rotation. We've identified some development opportunities for him that we're going to work through. Do you think the Red Sox... Kyle Harrison is still in the Red Sox. Do you think the Red Sox think he could pitch in the front of a rotation right now? No, no way.
I'm trying to imagine if he is at any point, something has gone very wrong with all due respect to Kyle Harrison.
James so Tibbs far away
from, oh yeah. Oh,
James Tibbs III, a first rounder from last year, has an athletic profile. Someone that makes great swing decisions. Someone we think can excel in our player development infrastructure. James Tibbs III is now with the Dodgers after being traded at the deadline for Dustin May, who is now on the Cardinals. They also got someone named Jose Bayo, who I admittedly don't know anything about. Maybe he's a Cy Young candidate. The Devers trade gets worse and worse and worse. And yet it's not the worst trade that the Red Sox have made in the last decade. You know, like that's pretty
well. How about that? Anyway, good job, White Sox. A couple more. Jacob Wilson, 7 years, $70 million extension with the A's of Yolo County. The A's have spent less money in free agency than every team in baseball this offseason. However, they continue to extend their young players and have now extended Wilson, Lawrence Butler, Brent Rooker, and Tyler Soderstrom all within the last like year and a half, which makes sense because all those guys are pretty good. So good for Jacob Wilson. Congrats to him. And hopefully they can find someone to pitch in the near future so these guys aren't scoring runs for nothing. Good for Jacob Wilson. Happy for him. David Robertson has retired. David Robertson, what a strange end to his career. But he rode it out for quite some time. He was, I mean, how many, quick pop quiz, how many major league games did David Robertson pitch in?
In his life?
Yeah.
Probably sure. Like, how many games? I don't know, friggin' 780?
881. That is a lot of times to come into a Major League Baseball game. And now his career is over. He pitched for 8 different teams, mostly with the Yankees. And yeah, this was interesting. I saw MLB posted this, a thank you, David Robertson. How good do you have to be thanked by MLB? For example, Avisail Garcia just announced his retirement. I assume MLB will not be thanking him.
He didn't get a thank you card? Thank you for your service?
That's the thing. Because thank you for your service time, in David Robertson's case, makes plenty of sense. I mean, he was contributing to Major League Baseball for a long time. Like, this I'm not disagreeing with.
The Yankees thanking him makes sense. Like, thank you, David Robertson. The league thanking him, like, did David Robertson change baseball? I guess is the question.
No, I don't think so. Like, you can tell the history of baseball without him.
Yeah.
But he had some real moments. I mean, he was a very important part of those Yankees teams, for sure.
His final outing, he could also pull a Clemens and just come back at the deadline. Like, it wouldn't shock me. He totally literally did that last year. If he is done, though, his final outing was in Game 1 of the NLDS this year. Got the final out of the 6th inning against the Dodgers. Came back out inexplicably for the 7th inning. Was allowed to face Andy Pages and Will Smith, single, hit by pitch. In came Matt Strom. Teoscar 3-run home run, and the Dodgers were on their way. Last thing before we take our last break, the trial of the century is upon us. Tomorrow, on Wednesday, Tarek Skubal in the blue and orange shorts, the Detroit Tigers in the blue and orange shorts, facing off in the arb hearing heard around the world. Tarek Skubal would like $32 million, please. The Detroit Tigers would like to give him just $19 million, please. In my personal opinion, those are both ludicrous amounts of money to make. They should go to the sanitation workers or whatever. However, this is one of the most fascinating arb cases we've ever had. And I Googled trial of the century. There is a Wikipedia page for the term trial of the century. There are already like 25 or so options for the 21st century. Maybe I'll go on there and try and add Scoobal myself. You know, you can do that on Wikipedia.
I am so excited to find out what happens here. I would encourage everyone to go read what Jake wrote about this situation. If you are curious about the background, you can just search Jake Mintz.
Last thought here.
Scoobal, trial of the century.
Oh, I don't know. Should have been the headline. If you're a Tigers fan, who are you rooting for? Right? It's because like you want obviously the Tigers fans are mad at the team and happy for Scoobal. But if you're living in a pragmatic world, you kind of want Scoobal to not get paid so that they can then spend the money, even though they should be spending the money anyway, even if he does get paid. But like it's a very bizarre thing. If you're a fan, so right? Weird. It has to be. If you're a Tigers fan, any Tigers fan listening to this pod is probably like, I hope Scoobal gets his money, like screw the team or whatever. If you're charging hard for the Detroit Tigers or you're riding with Scoobs, send us an email, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com.
And at the very least, what a moment for the Scobo. So we will have a ruling. This is as clear cut as it gets. One side will be a win or a loss. There will be no draw in this. I mean, I guess if they settle in the next 24 hours, that would end up being a draw. But anyway, it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. So we will talk about that later this week. We're going to take a break. When we return, finally, everyone's been eager for it. Let's talk insurance. We'll be right back.
Getting old comes with many unfortunate realities. My back hurts. The pipes in my apartment froze. But I would say like the worst part about getting old is dealing with insurance. And that's something that we need to talk about. Insurance. You got it. I got it. We all need it. Whether you're insuring your car, your home, your life, anything is insurable. Even the contracts of incredibly wealthy Major League Baseball players. And those insurance nitty-gritties flew into the forefront over the weekend as a number of players in the WBC were denied insurance to participate in the tournament, most notably Francisco Lindor, Carlos Correa earlier in the week. This led to a firestorm of frustration online. A lot of confusion about the antiquated, arcane insurance process. I wrote about this over at Yahoo. You can read my words with your eyes. You can also listen to my words with your ears as I will do my best to explain this situation to you. Jordan, what do you want to know about this? Because I'm sure you have educated yourself somewhat. But how can I help you understand this?
I think the first place to start is, why is this relevant now? Because I think a lot of people are wondering, well, I don't remember hearing about this in 2023. Why has this become such a big issue this time around? The one other thing I just want to say to kind of set the stage, and then you can take us through it quickly, is the timing is important, right? The rosters for the WBC are due, I believe, today, like essentially right now. They are set to be officially announced on Thursday evening. There's going to be some changes between now and then. Guys will get hurt and drop out, whatever. But you really got to set your team by this week. And because of that, as teams were making those final decisions and submitting their final decisions, getting insurance in a lot of these cases is a big part of that process. But I bring it back to my first question, which I think a lot of people are wondering, why has this become particularly relevant this year compared to 3 years ago?
My understanding, and I spent the weekend on many phone calls with various people trying to figure this out, there is a discernible uptick in the stringency, in the strictness of the insurance company involved this season compared to 2023. And that is directly related to two high-profile injuries that happened in the 2023 tournament. Edwin Diaz tearing his ACL while jumping up and down after a victory. As fluky as it was, it did happen in the WBC. He missed the whole season. Jose Altuve got hit on the hand by a pitch, fractured his thumb, missed 2 months. When those players get hurt, the insurance company makes the MLB team financially whole. Right. So the insurance company paid the Mets for the entirety of Edwin Diaz's 2023 contract. That is an expensive outlay. And for that reason, the insurance company is kind of raising the threshold a little bit this go around. As much of a bummer as that is, I do think that that part of it makes rational sense. Right. Like cold hard math, Jordan, you understand why the insurance company would go about it in that manner. I do think it is important to say this has happened in previous editions. Most notably, Clayton Kershaw in 2023 was expecting to pitch. He did not receive insurance and had to pull out pretty late in the process. That is related to the Team USA discussion right now. It has been noticed that Team USA has not had many or any really high-profile insurance claims denied. My understanding, based upon multiple conversations, is that is related to Mark DeRosa having gone through this process before. Team USA's manager was understandably frustrated when he found out Kershaw wasn't going to participate. And you can make a decent argument that not having Kershaw, who at that point would have probably been the best pitcher on the team, not having him hurt USA's chances in the tournament, right? Now, they didn't lose to Japan in the final because Kershaw wasn't there. They didn't hit because the Japanese team was incredible. But that played a role. And so this time around, DeRosa and I believe the GM is Michael Hill for Team USA, they took that into mind, into account, and are not like asking players where there are going to be insurance questions, right? Or did not commit to those players far in advance. Mike Trout is the most obvious example of this where, like, is Mike Trout currently good enough to be on Team USA? Probably. He's not like a shoe-in, but you would expect the guy who was the captain last time would probably be on the roster. Now, because Trout has had so many injuries over recent seasons and has so much money left on his contract with the Angels, it would be very difficult to believe that Trout would get insurance coverage moving forward. And therefore, DeRosa and co effectively, my understanding, like removed Trout from the process, or at least like didn't commit to him earlier. Maybe he's on the eventual roster, but like, they're waiting for those insurance claims to go through before they make these public announcements. Now, why didn't and hasn't Puerto Rico done that? So Puerto Rico is kind of the victim of this whole thing because Lindor and Correa are their two best and most prominent players. Lindor is a top five player in the history of Puerto Rican baseball, and he's still at his peak. Puerto Rico, crucially, is hosting games in San Juan for the first time since 2023. And so the frustration around Correa and Lindor potentially not playing is significant. But Puerto Rico simply doesn't have a deep enough player pool to draw from. If they don't get Correa and Lindor, they can't pivot to Gunnar Henderson or Bobby Witt or Trey Turner or any other number of American all-star shortstops, right? Puerto Rico can't do that. And so I think that's kind of where this frustration comes from. As far as I understand it, there's no grand plan here. People at the league office are not like conniving and scheming to not have Francisco Lindor play in the tournament. Like the MLB who runs, not runs the tournament, but has tons of control over the tournament, wants the best players playing, right? They want Francisco Lindor to play. They will sell more tickets in Puerto Rico. There will be more hype about the tournament. It is a good thing if he plays. And I think between now and when the rosters are due to be submitted, which is like later today, I do think that the league is going to do everything it can in its power and the Players Association to see if they can get these guys covered. Now, the last point I'll make, Jordan, there's like a million more things here. The last point I'll make, as far as I understand it, you can put an uncovered player on the 35-man roster. So there's a 35-man roster, and I think it's a 28-man roster. You for the 20, like you need to submit the 35 this week. Right. Mm. And so you pull from that when you make your final 28, and that's so you have injury replacements. I do think the window here is a little bit longer. Like I would expect Correa to be on that larger roster just in case they can get approval for him between now and when the tournament starts. So this is all complicated. It's all convoluted. There's also like Ohtani announced that he's not pitching in the WBC, which was kind of framed as his own choice. Not really. Like,
well,
not. No, I don't believe that.
It's not even that. It was more of the sequence in classic Dodger fashion of Shohei telling reporters, "I'm still deciding." And then Dave Roberts saying, "He's not pitching." Like 20 minutes later. It was a great series of events. The thing I'll just add about the situation, and it is really unfortunate, and I feel for Puerto Rico, because to me, it's just the ultimate bad bounce and bad sequence. You mentioned that that Team USA was thoughtful about who they were picking. Let's be honest, they were fortunate that what is looks yes. to be essentially 95% of the best possible team all fit into the qualifications of being able to get insurance because of their respective contract situations, because of how healthy they were this past year, whatever. You can say that there's still some where it's like, what about that guy? He was hurt. What about that guy? He missed time. And I think that that's fair for casual fans to look at the situation and wonder the differences. But obviously, I don't think anyone that has a rational view of this really would believe that there's any sort of conspiracy against any team having some sort of disadvantage. Because to your point, the league wants all the best players playing in this. It's part of MLB sport. They'd rather make this as good as possible. It's the teams are the ones that are more worried. But for the most part, players want to play. And if they can get insured, they're going to go do that because it's a really important event to them. And especially in the case of Puerto Rico, when you just have a much more top-heavy roster, it sucks if you can't get your best guys. That is definitely going to impact right. your ability to compete. And I hope that at least one of Lindor or Correa, if not somehow both, are able to play. But we will see. And obviously, Thursday night, we're going to get the full announcements, and we will talk about those on Friday. But yeah, I think that's kind of where we're at with it.
There's also the situation with Miguel Rojas of the Dodgers and Team Venezuela, who... there's a new stipulation in the insurance coverage where if you're 37 or older, you just don't get coverage. I don't think that that's fair. However, at the same time, like Miguel Rojas wasn't starting at shortstop or second base for Venezuela. Let's be real. It's unfortunate for him, but like that's not changing the course of Venezuela's tournament necessarily. Whereas like, dude, the fact that Acuña is playing.
Sure.
Like yeah. Ronald Acuña being in this tournament, having multiple ACL tears, is really a reminder that the contract is part of the conversation, where like there is way less money left on his deal than there is for Lindor, right? Lindor has 204, I think, 205 million left on the remainder of his deal. And I think Acuña, that number is like under 40, definitely under 50. Where, and Buxton is another injury plagued guy. He only has 45 million left on his deal. Right. And so that's like what the insurance company is thinking about. My last yeah. point I'll make, though, is like,
yeah.
And what I failed to get a good answer on really from anybody is think about this like car insurance. OK, if I'm a parent and my kid's a crappy driver, I'm going to just have to pay a higher premium. If there's more risk involved in whatever I'm insuring, the price just goes up. Now, at some point, my child could be a bad enough driver that no insurance company would ever, you know, want to take my money. But there's a price for everything. And so what I am curious about is like, if the WBC organization, of which MLB and MLBPA is a large part, if they go to the insurance company and they say, hey, we really want to have Lindor in this tournament. If the Puerto Rican Federation says, hey, we really want to have Lindor in this tournament. Would all those groups, like, is there a number where the insurance company would be like, yeah, we would insure him for that. We would insure him. Like, there's no way that Aaron Judge's contract is being insured for the same amount as Ernie Clement's contract, right? Mm-hmm. And so if there's variation in the level where you're buying in, couldn't you just pay way more money to insure Lindor?
that is where I am completely sympathetic to any fan of any of these teams that is like, I don't get why these things are different. It sucks that we have to talk about this, that this is impacting the rosters in this way. I think the Lindor thing is so specific and so unfortunate that I don't want that to color the whole situation and the whole process, but I totally understand why it does. And it sucks that we have to talk about it in these ways, regardless of who is at fault for these processes being in place.
Yeah. Well, so that's the thing. I don't know if anybody is at fault. Like, I don't think there's like, like a obvious blame recipient here. Ken Rosenthal and Evan Drellick wrote a good story about this at the Athletic, but there was one thing in there that I kind of took issue with. And I think we can, you know, we love Ken and Evan, but like there was a line in the story about how fewer players are going to be fewer elite players are going to be participating in this tournament. The heightened insurance concerns stem from injuries to Altuve and Diaz, which created aftershocks that will lead to fewer star players on the field in MLB's international tournament this spring. So that's not true. That last point. If you look at the top 10 players in the league on, you know, MLB Network's rankings this year compared to 2023, the best players are there. Like, the best players are going. 9 of the top 10 are going versus 7 of the top 10 last time. No matter what top value you use, the same amount, if not more, elite players are going to be involved in the tournament. And that is a good thing. And despite how much this sucks for Puerto Rico and Lindor and whatever, the tournament is in a good, healthy spot. It is on the upswing, and that is a good thing. That's all I have to say.
Yeah. I don't know how you could look at the Team USA roster and come to that conclusion. Yes, we're going to be missing some of the best players in the sport, but I'm pretty excited for this tournament. And on Friday, you will really hear that excitement ratchet up as we do get these rosters and fill out a lot of rosters that we really have not even come close to filling out yet, right? A lot of Team Venezuela, I'm very curious to see. A lot of Team Italy, I'm very excited to see what that team looks like.
Oh, yeah.
Mexico, Colombia, like there's some really interesting squads that we have not actually seen the even close to their full rosters yet. So we will talk about that on Friday from Buffalo, New York, where Jake and I will be taking in a little Sabres hockey on Thursday night. Oh my goodness, did you see that Tage Thompson goal last night? That was freaking sweet.
Woo!
But we've gone long, which means we're done talking on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Thank you, Jake Mintz, for potting with me as always. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing. Email us, baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. If you take issue with anything we said on this show, let us know. We appreciate it. Got a lot of good emails recently. Until Friday, have a good week, everybody. Goodbye.